context that we were going to examine. Once again, we finished looking at my obligations towards my competition, and then we began discussing my obligations towards my customers and my clients. And in particular, we talked about the concept of what is called mekach to'os. Mekach to'os means any transaction which is under a fundamental mistake. That means to say, if I buy something and it turns out to be defective, it doesn't work, etc. So there is a concept under those circumstances that the sale is considered fraudulent. And as a result, according to Jewish law, I have the right to cancel the sale and get my money back, even if there's no money back guarantee. Now, this principle of mekach to'os, number one, does not require that the seller know there was a problem and didn't tell me. Even if the seller didn't know either. If there was a fundamental mistake, you can cancel the transaction. And of course, halacha totally rejects the distinction between lying and not telling the truth, right? In secular law, there's still a major distinction between I can't lie, but I don't have to tell you the truth if you don't ask. That's called caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. In halacha, we believe failure to tell the whole truth is equivalent to lying, and therefore there is a basis for that rescission. And this is the principle of mekach to'os, which is still a halacha that applies in all sales that require the seller to reveal to the buyer any potential problem. Now, I had mentioned that according to some opinions, there is one exception to that rule, and that is if the buyer is given the opportunity to test or use the object, and had the buyer tested it or used it, the buyer would have discovered there was a problem. Let's say it's a test drive, so even driving the car around the block, the buyer would have discovered it. Then some say the seller has discharged his halachic responsibility by giving the buyer permission to use it. If the buyer then says, I don't want to do it, then that's considered what is called mechila. Mechila means the buyer has in effect waived or forgiven any problems. Because if it's a problem, I shouldn't say any problems, but the problems that would have been uncovered by the test use, the stuff that doesn't happen until later, that he hasn't forgiven, but the stuff that would have been revealed around the block, if the buyer says, I don't have to test it, the buyer is in effect saying, I don't really care if there's that problem or not. Even there, the seller can't lie. In other words, the seller can't lie and say there's no problem because, well, after all, if there was a problem, you could have found out about it. It's only the seller doesn't have a chiyuv to go ahead and mention it. Right, so those are, and then the other thing we mentioned in terms of my obligations towards customers is not to give my customers advice, even if it doesn't involve lying, that is not in their best interest. That's the law, that's the negative prohibition of, I'm sorry, is this sign? Yeah, that is the negative prohibition of lifnei iver, yeah, lasite michshol, not to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. Let me just mention a few other things, just be aware of some of the halachas that apply. Does halacha impose price controls? This is something that's often misunderstood. Price controls mean, is there any limit on how much I can charge you? Let's assume that I'm honest. Let's assume I say, listen, I'm charging you $1,000 for this quart of milk. I'm not lying, I'm not deceiving you, I'm just telling you, you need milk, you gotta pay $1,000. Does halacha impose any restriction on how much profit a person can make on what he sells? So the truth of the matter is, the Torah does not, and here's an important point that people sometimes are confused with. There is the law of the Torah that is called Ona'ah. Ona'ah means overcharging. It is prohibited to overcharge. That's what the Torah says. In the Mishnah and the Talmud, overcharging is defined as anything that is 1/6 or over. But or over what? It's going to be critical. 1/6 or over. Meaning to say, I can only charge less than 1/6. Now, the way this is explained in the Talmud is the following. This does not refer to how much you can charge over your cost. This is a common mistake. If I spent $1 for something, I could charge you $100, and even though that's, you know, 100 times more than my cost, right? So it's really 1,000 times profit compared to the dollar. I'm sorry, 100 times traffic, but nevertheless, it is permitted. Onah, rather, means the following. You cannot charge more than 1/6 over the prevailing market retail price for that object. It's a totally different basis. Now, how you figure that out is very complicated because every store on a block may have a different price. But in the olden days, standard prices were much more of the norm in a given locality. So if your price is out of whack and the buyer didn't know that, even if the buyer was negligent in not doing comparison shopping, the laws of Onah says that your price cannot be 1/6 or more out of whack with other prices. So the example, now 1/6, by the way, is computed on the final price, which is really 1/5. In other words, the example would be, let's say the prevailing price for an article is $100. Okay? So the permissible price that you can charge is $120. Because that's considered to be 1/6, because if you look at the final price, in other words, the concept is you divide the old price, the standard price, by 5, add on that standard, that'll give you 1/6 or less. So you could charge, if the standard price is 100, you can charge up to and not including $120. If you charge $120 or more, so the buyer is entitled to the refund. Actually, the Gemara makes many chilukim. The Gemara says, if you're out of sync by less than 1/6, in other words, prevailing price is 100, and you charge 110, so the sale remains the way it is, and the buyer has no right to a refund. If you are exactly at the 1/6 point, meaning standard price is 100, however you got that, and the buyer is paying 120, the exact 1/6 point, so the buyer is entitled, the transaction remains, but the buyer is entitled to a refund of the overcharge, meaning $20, which is very strange, right? Because if you charge them $119, right, or $119.99, buyer gets no refund at all. If you charge that one extra penny, bringing it up to 120, buyer doesn't only get a refund of the one penny, buyer gets a refund of the whole $20. If you charge $121, more than 1/6, then the halacha is the buyer at his option can cancel the entire transaction and get a full money back guarantee. Now, as I said, I'm going to say, that is the law called Onah, but the point I want to make is this. Onah is simply a requirement that retail prices be in line with the existing market. It does not at all refer to how much profit you can make on your cost. Which means to say, if everybody is charging 1,000% profit, and therefore you're charging 1,000% profit, is not out of kilter with other prices, then you are allowed to charge that profit as well. Meaning to say, if we were to ask, actually the truth is it's very interesting, it's almost exactly the opposite of what is condemned under American law. Under American law, what is condemned is price fixing. That's where all the competitors get together and agree to charge the same price. You know, that is a violation of United States law. That's a violation of the antitrust law. It would appear, subject to the exceptions I'm going to mention in a moment, it would appear that halacha has created a system, this is a little difficult to understand, which actually encourages collusion and price fixing in the sense that the laws of Onah permit any type of price you want to charge for a commodity as long as it's not out of sync with the standardized average market price. It's a peculiarity which is difficult to understand. Now again, I'm not going to fully address how do you determine standard market price. That's very, very difficult. But for our purposes, I think the point is we want to see the negative here, and that is halacha does not in and of itself, subject to some major exceptions I'll talk about, condemn excessive profiteering if it's not out of sync with the general market. Yeah, did you want to say?
I want to make sure I understand how you're computing that.
Yes.
That
1/6?
$20 is 1/5 of 100.
That's correct.
But when you go 120, it's 6 That's
sick
correct.
Part. That's correct.
That's
how it works. That's right. Okay. In other words, the sixth is computed after you've added on the extra money that you're charging.
So you really add on a fifth, and then it
that's
becomes
right.
one.
That's right.
One
As a practical
sixth.
Matter, it will be easier actually to say you add on a fifth. That would be the way we. That is the way we would talk in English. The Talmudic terminology is you add on a sixth, but it's really adding on a fifth.
Kind of like you said, 40 yeah. minus one.
Right, so similarly going backwards, right? You're going, yeah, right. Now, here's the thing. Although the law of Ona'a itself is not a limitation on profit, and it must be understood it is not a limitation on profit, there are other principles in Jewish law that do talk about limitations on profits. And this is a Gemara in Bava Basra, which, number one, there are all sorts of curses, moral opprobrium, moral condemnation on people who charge excessive prices for necessities of life. Now, the Talmud does not clearly always define what is an excessive price, but these people are called mafkiei sha'arim, those who artificially inflate prices to make excessive profit. This also refers to people who, for example, will buy up a lot of food supplies in hoarding in anticipation of scarcities, and then they'll selectively release a little bit at a time, right? So these people are, in the pantheon of evildoers, they are rated very, very high. They are sharply condemned. In particular, the Gemara in Bava Basra indicates, and this may sound fairly generous, but it does say that for food suppliers, they cannot have a margin of profit that is more than 50%. But again, 50% defined as 100%. I mean to say that which they bought for 50, they are not allowed to sell for more than 100. Okay, so their profit margin cannot be more than 50% of their price. Now keep in mind that the Talmudic computation of profit includes a lot of things that we would call expenses. It includes time and the like. But over the out-of-pocket expense, you can have a 50%. And according to some opinions, the 1/6 rule does apply to food as well, meaning to say, as a limitation of cost, meaning if I spent 100, regardless of the prevailing market, I cannot charge more than 120. So there are various rules pertaining to food and necessities which limit profit. But then there's another ruling in the Talmud that's even more relevant. And that is, the Talmud indicates that local Jewish communities have the autonomous authority to impose price ceilings if it feels that people are being victimized. Meaning, even if the halacha does not create a rule limiting profit, halacha recognizes that communities have the right to limit profit if people cannot afford basic necessities. And in fact, we find in the Talmud mention of community boycotts in order to get prices down. The Talmud mentions that there was a certain fisherman who was supplying fish to a Jewish community for Shabbos, and since everyone needed fish for Shabbos, so he was raising the prices very high, so the rabbis ruled nobody should eat fish on Shabbos anymore until the price goes down. In other words, boycott. And through the boycott, the price was lowered, and then the rabbi lifted the ban. We also find the notion of a boycott in connection with religious articles, very, very interestingly enough. You know, there's a machlokas in the Gemara. This is an interesting little case history about, you know, the hadassim that you have for a lulav, the myrtle. So, if you recall, how many myrtles do you have in a lulav? You have three. Now, we rule that you're supposed to have three complete myrtles. They shouldn't be broken off. But there is one opinion in the Mishnah that says even a broken off one is okay. So the Gemara mentions a story that there was a time in which the myrtle salesmen were charging very high prices. So a rabbi called them in and said, you either lower your prices or we will tell people the halacha is like the opinion that all you need is a broken one, and as a result, you're not going to be able to charge so much for your high quality ones. This was a threat, very strange thing in a way. This was a threat to issue a halachic ruling like the minority opinion unless the prices were lowered. And indeed this threat was effective. So the notion of communal enactments and the notion of boycott was considered to be a legitimate weapon in halacha to be able to force a more reasonable reduction of prices. Now, the reason this comes up now, because you occasionally hear suggestions around Pesach time, where people feel that in the States in particular, prices are much higher than they normally are, that perhaps we should have rabbinically sanctioned boycotts of a given store or a given manufacturer in order to force the price down. There is certainly Talmudic precedent for that. I also know that in Baltimore for many years, they had a rule that no lulav and esrog could be sold, and this was about 15 years ago, for more than $35. This was a time, actually I was here this year, I don't even remember what the lulav and esrog cost in the States, but if you want to get a nice lulav and esrog, really the lulav you get for free, but you're paying for the esrog. If you want to get a nice esrog, it does cost $80, $90, or even $100.
$120?
Okay. So it's very expensive. But in those days, 15 years ago, you could get a very nice esrog for around $60. But many people with large families couldn't afford it. So the city of Baltimore, the rabbinic leadership in the city of Baltimore, made a takana that no esrog could be sold for more than $35. And they even made something which I don't know how it's enforceable. They even said, no Jewish resident of Baltimore is allowed to go out of Baltimore to buy. Again, that wasn't, obviously that wasn't enforceable, but they even said it that way. So this was an attempt to cap the profits that esrog processors and dealers were making. But you know what the effect was? It just shows you that with economics is a very delicate balance. The effect was, and I noticed this myself, that the grade A esrogim were simply not available in Baltimore. Meaning, there are many grades of esrog. You could always get an esrog for $35. But the concept in Baltimore was an attempt to be able to get a grade A esrog for $35. That doesn't work. If I'm an esrog dealer, and I could sell my grade A stuff in New York for $60, $70, or $80, why should I ship any grade A stuff to Baltimore for
$35?
Huh?
All the dempy ones go to Baltimore.
That's correct. So basically what happened was you could not get a beautiful esrog in Baltimore because of that. Now, if, on the other hand, you had a truly national boycott or you had a truly regional market, either way, in other words, if there were esrogim produced in Baltimore, this might have some effect. The way it is now, there was a trade-off. Now, again, the Baltimore rabbinate thought that even if it meant that Baltimore was getting inferior esrogim, it was still worthwhile. But you see, there's going to be a cost here. You can't expect, you get what you pay for, basically. And if somebody could get more money for a better esrog, they're not going to send the better esrog to Baltimore. But that is the point. The point I want to make, therefore, is ona'a per se is not a limitation on profits. It's simply a requirement that your market price fit the hypothetical market price within a certain variation. However, tools such as boycotts and rules regarding necessities of life in times of scarcity would give a beis din the power, if you had a beis din that had the power, generally, to order sellers to lower their prices or order the community not to deal with those particular sellers. Okay, so that's the idea of profit, price controls and profiteering restrictions. Another issue, again, are billing problems, collection methods. You know that one of the issues in business is bills are not always paid, and I got to find ways, if I'm in business, of collecting money that is owing to me. And we know that debt collection, historically, has been an area where there have been many abuses. Right? Typical examples are that a person who owes money might be called up and say, are you so-and-so? Oh, your wife is in the hospital. You better come down right away. In other words, there are ways of scaring people and intimidating people. There are all sorts of informal debt collectors, guys, big guys who walk in with motorcycle jackets and everything else, and, baseball bats. And that's one way of collecting debts and the like. And we have, under federal law, something that is called the Fair Debt Collection Act, which sets up a bunch of procedures for the collection of debt. Jewish law also has a principle here, and that is a law in the Torah, a negative commandment in the book of Deuteronomy, that says, Lo sia lo kanosha. That means, do not be a harassing creditor in collecting a debt. And this means practically the halacha, you are not allowed to attempt to collect a debt from a person if they are in the situation that they are unable to pay you. That doesn't mean you forgive the debts. It doesn't mean you write it off. But it means you have to wait until the person is in a position where they reasonably can pay you in one way or another. Now, what that means, when they are or when they aren't, is of course a difficult question. Many people, you know, say they can't afford it when they perhaps could afford it. Very often people can't afford the whole thing, but they could afford something, right? But the point is, don't put pressure on people beyond their particular ability to pay. In fact, the Gemara says that some rabbis were so sensitive to this that they would never walk by the house of somebody who owed them money, lest when that person sees them, they get embarrassed and humiliated, and that causes them a tinge of anxiety or guilt. I remember a story years ago. I attended a conference, a law teaching conference in Cincinnati. And one of the presentations in this law teaching conference involved the teaching of Jewish law in law schools. I don't know if you know this, but actually in many secular law schools, courses are actually offered in Jewish law. In some schools, they're offered by frum people, which is okay, I guess. Other schools, they're offered by people who are not particularly either learned or religious. But even if you go to the Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, NYU, University of Pennsylvania, Stanford, all of the George Washington, many, many well-known law schools offer courses in Jewish law. So 15 years ago, of course, one reason is because the Gliss family left $1 million to six law schools on the condition they establish a chair in Jewish law. And so even if a law school wasn't interested in Jewish law, they were interested in $1 million. So they decided to become interested in the teaching of Jewish law. But Harvard, I know, for the longest time, they specifically were looking for a non-Orthodox expert in Jewish law to teach. They really didn't want somebody from, and you know, they were like looking through the globe. So they wanted to get a Bible scholar who didn't really know any halacha or Talmud, but you know, his Bible, maybe that's close enough.
Why do they want them?
Huh?
Why do they want them? Yeah.
Why do they want? Well, they wanted to find somebody because they had $1 million, but they didn't want to get somebody from because. Harvard has a lot of Jewish faculty, and the Jewish faculty is by and large alienated from Judaism. So they regard Orthodox people as kind of reminders of the old ways that are no longer valid, etc. So they didn't want somebody who was Orthodox.
I have a question for you. I know you studied both. What was harder for you to learn, Talmud or American legal system?
Well, in a way, it's difficult to answer the question because I started learning Talmud when I was much younger. So as a result, it was harder for me. You know, it was harder to learn Talmud in seventh grade than it would be to learn law when you're 22 or 23.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say. I would say that Talmud was probably harder just because I started younger.
Does it have a lot more information?
It's a more intricate reasoning process. Yes. Law probably has more information. If you're talking about bits of information, yeah. Law has more bits of information, but the Talmud is a deeper and more intricate system of reasoning.
You find that, you study like pretty much all the aspects of American law or other law. You find that Talmud covers pretty much everything?
Yeah, oh yes. Talmud covers everything. I mean, obviously the Talmud deals with different situations. The Talmud deals with old situations, but in terms of the concepts, the conceptual structure, sure, every issue that American law addresses is fully addressed in the conceptual structure of the Talmud. The only question is, since the Talmud historically refers to different types of issues...
You can derive everything.
You can derive it, yeah, you can derive it. I mean, it's not that easy. That's not that easy to do, but everything is there. Just as we believe in the Torah, our responses and solutions to every conceivable problem that human beings do face. But you have to be able to, you know, extract it. That's a difficult process. But anyway, so in the Harvard situation, they finally, you know, they really looked the whole world to find somebody who wasn't religious. They really didn't find it, so they finally broke down, and now they made it a visiting professorship. They didn't want the person to be permanently enshrined there, but every year they get a different person. But anyway, the reason I'm bringing up the story is that in 1983, this is when Jewish law first began to be taught in secular law schools. So there were two presenters about how to teach Jewish law. One was a professor who's now in Israel, a yeshiva-educated lawyer, a very scholarly, learned, etc. No, it was not me, no. A scholarly person. And his presentation was designed to make the case that whatever secular law does, Jewish law does too. In other words, he wanted to show how Jewish law is comparable to secular law. The same analysis, the same reasoning. In other words, we're just as good. Whatever you have, we're just as good or we're better. Therefore, you should accept us and embrace us. The second presenter was a Mormon who taught at Brigham Young University. And he taught Jewish law. Now, you'd wonder, number one, he was not Jewish. Number two, Brigham Young University is the Mormon University in Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah. I very much doubt there are any Jewish students there, although you never know. And somehow, he got interested in teaching Jewish law. So he got up after this yeshiva-educated person who had smicha, rabbi, and said, you know, if all you want to say is Jewish law is the same as secular law, you're missing the points. What about the sanctity? What about the holiness? What about the nobility? What about the fact that this is God's will for man? So it just struck me as such an unusual thing that here you have the rabbi, the Talmud Chacham, etc., whose whole case was Jewish law is just as good as American law, therefore you ought to study it. And here we have the Mormon that was saying, no, you don't look at it as just as good. There's a spiritual element here. There's holiness. And then the Mormon went on and told the story, which showed that Jewish law is not just a theoretical study, but it's supposed to change your life. He said that he had lent somebody $1,000, and the person was very lax in paying him back. And this professor said he was getting angry and anxious, but then he learned the verse in Deuteronomy that says, you shall not harass a debtor who's unable to pay. And then he thought to himself, you know, if this person is in hard times, I ought to obey the word of God and be sympathetic to him and not look askance at it and not be anxious. After all, I would want God to cut me some slack, so I should learn to be forgiving of him. And he said, and because of that principle, he said, I sent him a turkey for Christmas, you know, and a card. You know, so the concept is...
The person has to wait like 7 years.
Well, the truth is, as you know, we do have Shemitah. If you don't pay your debt by the seventh year, it does get canceled. But there are ways of, there are ways of preventing that from happening. So you can kind of ensure that
you shouldn't, you shouldn't freak out because the seventh year is about to come.
Right. Let me address that a little bit. In fact, those of you that are learning Maseches Gittin, fourth parak, actually learned about this. You know, in American law, we have something called bankruptcy. And bankruptcy is a way of, if you have a lot of debt that you're unable to pay, or that you don't want to pay, actually that's a big problem. It doesn't have to be you're not able to, you don't want to pay a lot of debt. Right? Let's say you just owe a lot of money. So one of the things you can do is you can file in a court, in a bankruptcy court, a petition, it's called, for bankruptcy, and you give up whatever assets you have, or there are other types of bankruptcy. Actually, I'll talk about this in greater length, but the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, from your perspective, is that when you successfully go through a bankruptcy process, all money that was not paid off simply gets erased from the slate. That is called a bankruptcy discharge. Now, not everything gets erased. As you would expect, most tax bills do not get erased. After all, Congress writes these bankruptcy laws, and consequently they put in exceptions for money that is owed to the federal government in the form of taxes. Alimony and child support is not erased if you owe your former spouse, you know, $1,000. Bankruptcy doesn't work for that. But other than those things, bankruptcy can erase a tremendous amount of things. It can erase bank loans. It can erase tuition obligations. It can erase medical expenses, right? So bankruptcy simply erases the slate. You don't have to pay. And not only that, but if your creditor tries, credit card bills, if your creditor tries to collect from you after you've been through a bankruptcy, that creditor is violating the law and can be subject to contempt of court sanctions. In other words, a court could fine him or put him in jail even for failure, for circumventing the bankruptcy discharge. Now, in Jewish law, there is no such thing as a discharge, meaning to say, if you can't afford to pay, I'm not allowed to harass you. I got to give you time. I got to work something out with you. But there's never a situation where you can simply get out of paying. Even if you win the lottery 50 years from now, I can go after you. But the one exception is the institution of Shemitah, which is the sabbatical year. Now, most of us know about the sabbatical year as it's practiced in Israel. Every seventh year, right, every 7 years. So the seventh year, the Torah says one is not allowed to work the land and plow the land and harvest and all those other things. As I may have mentioned, the Israeli chief rabbinate relies... Yes, the Israeli chief rabbinate relies on the concept that you can sell the land to Goyim. So consequently, during Shemitah, all arable, all farmable land in the state of Israel is said to belong to some Arab who lives in Katamon. So he's the largest landowner in the land of the state of Israel. But most religious Jews do not accept the chief rabbinate's viewpoint on this.
That really seems that the whole reason for Shemitah is for the fertile land.
That's correct. That's correct. So most religious Jews do not accept the chief rabbinate's decision. And in fact, a little bit of history, although this is a digression, is this psak that you can sell the land to the Goyim, technically, and then the Jew can continue to work the land, like everything, like you sell your chametz. This was a psak of Chief Rabbi Cook, Chief Rav Cook, in the aftermath of World War I. Now, in the aftermath of World War I, many, many Jews in Israel were on the verge of literal starvation. That if they would not be allowed to farm the land, people would die. People did die anyway. And consequently, Rav Cook issued his ruling on the basis of the extenuating circumstances of starvation that were prevailing in the land of Israel. And Rav Cook indicated himself that this was not intended to be a permanent precedent if the economic situation changed. Now, the Israeli chief rabbinate has consistently followed Rav Cook's psak, even though the situation has greatly changed. Number one, there's a tremendous market of foreign products coming, right? Shemitah laws only apply to farming in Israel, right? When you have the ability to import potatoes and bread and milk and everything else from Chutz La'aretz, there is no hedger. And consequently, most religious Jews do not rely on what is called the hedger mechira. Hedger mechira means a dispensation to sell the land. Yeah.
Isn't there a possible dangerous consequence there? I mean, I'm talking about divine consequences. If this is being violated, then this could have great consequences to the land.
Well, yes, it can. Of course, part of this is a technical discussion, whether the obligation of the Shemitah year is biblical or only rabbinic today. Some say that after the destruction of the temple, the observance of Shemitah is of rabbinic imperative and not biblical imperative. And consequently, the imprecations and the curses and the punishments would not necessarily attach in the same way. You know, and that itself is a major discussion. Yeah?
Well, then, what do religious Jews
do different things. Many religious farmers literally stop plowing and planting the land. They are permitted to harvest what grows up, for example, trees and the like, but they do not plow or harvest the land. There are, in fact, special kollelim, you know, for farmers. In other words, during Shemitah, they sit in kollel, and they may receive stipends for their kollel learning, and they're allowed to do maintenance duties. In other words, they're allowed to take the steps in their fields in order to prevent disintegration, but they're not allowed to do things that facilitate new growth. Now, that is agricultural Shemitah, and that's not what we're talking about now. However, what is less known to people is... Oh, I'm sorry, just one question
before we get off the agricultural subject. I've heard that there's actually cases of, you know, it says in the Torah that, you know, you receive three times the yield in the sixth year.
Yes.
And there's actually cases, even in modern times, of farmers, religious farmers, who obey the law to the letter, and in fact they receive an amazing three times
yes,
yield in the sixth year.
Absolutely. You know, there are many, many anecdotes, many, many stories of people who violated Shemitah and their crops got destroyed by hailstorms, some hailstorm in the middle of the summer or the like. And the Jew who didn't keep Shemitah, the Jew who kept Shemitah on the sixth year got this 300% yield that carries him through Shemitah by the sixth year, the seventh year, and even the eighth year until it's time to harvest the crop. Yes, there are many, many stories of this bracha even in modern times.
So then if Rav Cook, you know, said let's not do it because of starvation, did he ever give it? Did he ever give it a chance to see if it would work? In other words, I mean, it seems like it almost like let's not even give it a chance. Let's forget the Shemitah year.
Well, yeah. In defense of Rav Kook, when people are actually starving, you can't really. In other words, the general philosophy of the Torah is that you don't rely on miracles openly. And that is to say, if people are starving, we have to find a way to feed them. We can't assume God will make a miracle.
But he said he would. I mean, we're not asking for a miracle. He didn't say
I understand that.
The situation is very different nowadays from when Rav Kook died.
Oh, yes, that's a separate issue, but he's asking even in Rav Kook's time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you see, this gets back to the very technical question, which I don't want to fully address, and that is, if Shemitah, after the destruction of the temple, is rabbinic, then there's some question whether the Torah's blessing automatically attaches. Now, it seems in the course of years that it does. People have been blessed. On the other hand, Rav Kook, who concluded that Shemitah was rabbinic, came to the conclusion that there's no guarantee in that case. Yeah.
Just as a matter of policy, why couldn't he have ruled that because of the extenuating circumstances of Kutzbach, it would have been a lot cleaner decision?
Yes. Well, the reason basically is that Rav Kook could see no basis to allow a Jewish-owned property to be worked during the Shemitah. In other words, the most he could allow would be the circumvention of that restriction by a formalistic sale to a non-Jew. He didn't simply say it's okay to do it. Now, that's not the Shemitah I wanted to bring in here. That's agricultural Shemitah. But there's a lesser-known aspect of Shemitah that is also in the Torah. And this lesser-known aspect, by the way, is not limited to Israel. It applies in America, it applies throughout the world. And that is, the passing of the sabbatical year effects the cancellation of all indebtedness. What does that mean? If I owe you $1,000, and the Shemitah year comes and goes, I do not have to pay you that $1,000 anymore. Shemitah cancels the debts. Now that is called Shemitas Kisafim. That means the cancellation of money. And the Torah talks about this, and the Torah indeed talks about how rich people might not want to lend money if it's too close to the Shemitah year, because, by the way, Shemitah cancels debts at the end of the Shemitah, not at the beginning. That means to say, let's say Shemitah year is 5760. So if I lend you money in 5758, I could still go after you for the entire year of 5760 until Erev Rosh Hashanah, until Rosh Hashanah of 5761. Shemitah cancels at the end, not at the beginning. So it's different than the agricultural restrictions which kick in at the beginning of the year.
What year are we in right now?
Well, right now we're at 5759, but when is the next Shemitah? Honestly, I don't remember. We can figure it out, though, because if you just divide by 7, right, we're 5759, okay? So divide 5759 by 7, see how many groups of 7 you are, and the remainder will tell you your year. So that's 8, 56, 15 divided by 7.
The remainder,
if you divide, well, let's see what it is. Is that 5 that you get? 14, 19 divided by 7 is 2, remainder 5. So if that's correct, we are in the 5th year of the Shemitah cycle. So next year is 5760. So 5761 should be, based on this, the next Shemitah year. Right? 5761. Now, when there was a temple, by the way, this would get a little more complicated, because when there was a temple, you'd have to throw in the Jubilee year, which is every 50th year. You couldn't just divide it by 7, because every 50 years, you'd have another year in there. But today, we don't observe the Jubilee year.
That misses it all. Well, it was a temple.
Yes. You are correct. This is not a logical formula. This just happens to work. In other words...
Unless there were 7 Jubilee years.
Yeah. In other words, this happens to work. But you're right. This is not... In other words, this is not the technically accurate way of doing it. I just know that you will get the right answer this way. You're correct. Technically, you'd have to start from a different point because of the Yovel year. Now, if you learned Maseches Gittin, I guess some of you are learning the fourth chapter of Gittin, you know that there was already a problem during the Second Temple itself of lenders, and the Torah foresaw this problem, of lenders who would not be willing to extend money to poor people or anybody too close to the Shemitah year, because they figured if the poor person just pushes them off long enough, they're not going to have to pay back. Right, it takes time to collect money. So, you know, if it's only 3 months till the end of Shemitah, I could, you know, hide for 3 months, and then when you come after me after Shemitah, I'll say, ah, sorry, I don't have to pay you. So Hillel saw that the real people who were suffering here were not the rich people who weren't getting paid, but it was the poor people who no longer had access to credit because of Shemitah. So Hillel created a mechanism by which a loan would not be canceled after the Shemitah year. And the mechanism is something that is called a prosbo. That's one word, prosbo. And prosbo comes from the Greek, which means an enactment for the benefit of rich and poor. And what is a prosbo? A prosbo says that before the end of the sabbatical year, before the cancellation takes effect, a creditor should stand in front of a beis din of three rabbis and declare to those three rabbis, I hereby transfer all of the debts that are owed to me, and there's the money I'm entitled to collect, I transfer them to you, the court, and you hereby designate me as your agent to collect the money. Now, why does a prosbo work? Because there is a law that says money that is owed to a beis din, money that is owed to a court, Shemitah does not cancel. Let's say a traffic ticket, right? Shemitah does not cancel fines and money owed to a court. Prosbo was a way of ensuring that every private loan has now become a debt of the court, which you're allowed to thereby collect. Of course, in theory, the court should have the right to say, give us the money, not you. But the way it worked is, Hillel would understand that people wouldn't use a prosbo that way. They would just say, well, why should I do that? So essentially, the way it works is, I transfer my debt to the beis din, and the beis din gives me the right to then collect it as their shaliach. Now, prosbo does not require the consent of the debtor. The debtor doesn't have to be there. This is something I can, if I'm owed money, I can do it myself. So prosbo is one way in which one can avoid the Shemitah Kesafim. And this allows a creditor to collect money even after Shemitah, although it does indicate in the Mishnah that the pious thing to do is not to collect it. In other words, you should, but nevertheless, so you are halachically permitted to collect it. There are two more ways that a loan is not canceled during Shemitah. One is if you stipulate at the time of the loan, that this loan is being made on the condition that you will not invoke Shemitah as a defense. The Gemara in Makos says that is a valid condition. In other words, you will not use Shemitah as a reason not to pay me. But if I want to collect from you, you will not say that I can't because it's Shemitah.
But the excuse of I can't because I don't have money could still be used.
Well, yeah, but not to excuse you. In other words, you can delay payment.
But then you'll be put there at the end.
No, because you said that no. The condition was.
Oh, so Shemitah won't. Oh, Yevil won't apply to a loan.
Right, that's right.
So it'll go through to the next term, and you'll still owe me the money.
No. Shemitah does not. Yeah, that's right. Shemitah does not cancel a loan when you made that tonight.
I could collect.
Well, for all the years, because you say no, Shemitah will do it.
And so on every loan, you can black out Shemitah.
That's correct. The Gemara calls that a monetary condition, and when it's a matter of money, the parties can make conditions even against the Torah because it's a matter of their money. Right. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't really catch the question. Whether the prosbo applies to Yovel also?
No, prosbo does not apply to Yovel. Prosbo applies to Shemitah. I was just mentioning that there are two different ways you can avoid the law of Shemitah's Kesafim. One is by making a prosbo. The other is, and this is a different way, by stipulating at the time the loan is made that I'm lending you money on the condition that you do not use Shemitah as a way not to pay me. As you've been mochel your right to use Shemitah as a basis of cancellation.
Is there no way to get around Yovel?
Yovel doesn't cancel loans, only Shemitah cancels loans. Yovel doesn't
was
cancel.
Just returning the field.
That's right, Yovel does not cancel a loan at all. Yeah.
Does Shemitah only determine
the rise of the determine the obligation of the lover of the one to borrower to pay the the right to not pay the money back, but also the the obligation for the loaner to cancel to cancel the loan. I mean, it seems like if the borrower is allowed to make the condition,
yes.
Agree to the condition,
yes.
That
right.
Payback never
left,
it's only on his side.
Yeah, well, you have a good point, because the Gemara says that even if a loiva, let's say without a principal, without everything, a loiva simply brings back the money. In other words, I bring back the money after Shemitah. The Mishnah says there is a mitzvah on the borrower, on the creditor, on the malva, to say, you don't have to pay me. And if the loiva then says, I want to pay you anyway, then the malva is allowed to take it. But the malva initially must say, I don't want to take it. Now, however, in the case...
That would also apply to the case where the loaner only agrees to loan once the borrower agrees to still pay back?
Yes, yes. That apparently, I believe, it would not apply in that case.
Yeah.
In that particular case, there would be no obligation on the malva to even say, you don't have to pay me back. Property relationships, the parties have a power even to make that type of condition, because a person can do what he wants with his money, and therefore if a lova wants to give his money to the malva as a gift, in other words, essentially a lova doesn't have to pay, but he agreed to pay anyway, so that's tantamount to agreeing to make a gift which you didn't have to do.
This that seems to imply that there's a choice, but the guy says, I won't give you the loan unless you agree that you won't invoke this Shemitah.
Yes.
So then he didn't really have a choice. It wasn't that he's making a gift, it was that he can do whatever he wants with his money.
I understand.
He sort of, you know, all right, sure, I would
well,
do it.
Well, I understand. I mean, obviously, though, I can choose who I lend my money to. Meaning, if I were to go over to you and I would say, agree to this Shemitah clause or I'll break your arm, then your agreement would be involuntary, would be under duress, and it wouldn't be valid. But if I go over to you and I say, I'm not going to lend you the money unless you agree to my terms, that's not called halakhically coercion, because I'm not taking anything away from you that you already have.
But if the reason why this agreement can be brought to terms is that it's a person can do what they want with their money, and if they
right.
want to give it back
yes.
as a gift
yes.
beyond the Shemitah, that has to be a free.
I understand, but then we get into the question of free will, and that is, according to halacha, if somebody is angling for a certain benefit, such as access to a bank, and in order to get that benefit, they have to make a gift, that is called free will. See, I understand you're saying it's being done under pressure, but under halacha, that's not called pressure. Pressure is when you're threatening me with taking away that which I already have. If you threaten me by not giving me something new, that is not pressure. That is what free will is. Your free will is, it's more important for you to have the money, even if you're going to pay it back, than not to have the money. You see, in other words, halakhically, that would not be called duress. Duress would be if I were to say, you either agree to my terms or I'm going to take something away from you. Let me just mention one other way that the law of Shemitah does not apply, and that is loans that are covered by pledges. By a pledge, I mean collateral. Let's say I lend you $100 and I take your watch. You give me your watch to hold on to, meaning to ensure that you'll pay me, you basically give me your watch and you say, if I don't pay you in a year, you can keep the watch. So that's called a mashkon. Mashkon is physical collateral that is taken to secure the payment of the loan. So the Mishnah says in Masechet Shavuos that loans that are covered by collateral are not canceled, but again, it's a little tricky. That's only up to the amount of the collateral and not up to the amount of the loan. Let me give you an example. So if I lend you $1,000 and I take your Rolex watch, let's say, which is worth $500, then Shemitah will cancel the $500 over and above the value of the watch, but Shemitah will not cancel the $500 covered by the watch. So I either get to keep the watch or you can pay me $500 and get your watch back. So those are three. Again, without going into all of the halachos, the point to keep in mind is, number one, to be aware of the concept of Shemitas Kesafim, and to see the three ways that the halacha permits Shemitas Kesafim to be circumvented. One is the takana of Prisbul, which goes back to Hillel. The other is the condition at the time of the loan. And the third is the use of mashka. Yeah.
One of the ways to openly collect on debt. So, that's what your Shemitah, but if you have a borrower that perpetually says, I just can't pay, I can't pay.
Yes.
Is there at some point you have a right to receive and sell the collateral of this pledge?
Oh, sure. Particularly if you take a pledge. If you take a pledge, what a pledge means is that if the money is not paid by the agreed upon date, you go to a beis din. This is where the halakhic system would work. And the beis din would authorize, would give a certain redemption period, meaning it would give a final determination that you, Mr. Borrower, have 30 days to come up with the money and get back the watch. And at the end of that time, the watch would either be sold, or they could adjudicate that the creditor keeps the watch in satisfaction of the debt.
But if they sell the watch for $500,
yes, you do, because in particular, because up to hold otherwise would be a violation of the laws against interest, which are going to talk about. In other words, it wouldn't be possible to have an arrangement where if the collateral is more than the debt, the creditor gets the extra, because that would be equivalent to an interest payment.
So in an unsecured loan.
Yes.
Is there any action to take from unsecured loans?
Well, the halakhic collection system is very similar to the secular collection system. Property can be seized and sold, and then there's a list of exemptions. As in other words, the debtor is entitled to keep certain things that are necessary to live. In fact, the exemptions are fairly strict, so they're not as generous as some other exemption systems. So eventually property can be sold in order to pay back a debt. A debtor does not go into slavery. Remember, people make mistakes and those people say, oh, under Jewish law, people who don't pay their money get sold as slaves. That is not true. The only one who may get sold as a slave is a thief who is unable to make restitution. A borrower who doesn't pay back a debt does not get sold into slavery. It simply remains a debt until Shemitah, and even after Shemitah, it may remain a debt on him if the prisbul or the mashkon or this condition were implied.
A few questions on this, yeah. This whole idea of the loophole around the Shemitah.
Yes.
It almost seems like, you know, Hashem says there's this rule, do not add or subtract from the Torah. And all of a sudden you come up with this rule that says, oh, look at the Shemitah, you don't have to worry. I mean, you know, let's do it around the Shemitah. I mean, what's the purpose of the law? And how can you get around it?
The Gemara discusses that. You know, principle is often trotted out by proponents of people that say, hey, you could change the Torah if it's not working out well, because after all, isn't that what Hillel did, right? The Torah says Shemitah cancels debts, and Hillel says, hey, if you do this particular trick, Shemitah is not going to cancel the debt, right? So the Gemara asks the Kasha. The Gemara says, what gives Hillel the right to change the Torah here? And the Gemara's conclusion is Once again, it goes back to the Rav Kook idea that if Shemitah observance today is rabbinic and not of Torah level, then in effect, the Torah would say the loan is not canceled, and it's only the rabbinic Shemitah that cancels. So Hillel is not violating the Torah. Hillel is simply going back to what the law would be. But Ein Achinami, at a time when Shemitah would be a Torah law, the prisma would be ineffective. That's the Gemara's conclusion. Okay. That's how the Rambam. That's how the Rambam passes. The Rambam rules that a prisbal is an effective circumvention only when the cancellation principle is of rabbinic origin.
Okay.
That's my mind. Yeah.
Okay, the question is...
Not everybody agrees with that, but at least that's what the Rambam says.
Now, if you agree that you're going to observe Shemitah, and then the person doesn't pay you back, but then later on, there's no problem with if they voluntarily, after Shemitah, say, hey, I came into the money and I want to pay you, even though it was canceled in Shemitah, you can accept it, right?
So here's what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah deals exactly with your question. The Mishnah says that on one level, even after Shemitah, there is the Chachamim are very happy with a person who voluntarily decides to pay back the money. You don't have to, you can't be forced, but it's considered to be a moral and pious and ethical thing to offer to pay. And there's a little minuet. And it's an ethical thing for the creditor to say, you don't have to. And then you're supposed to say, but I want to do it anyway. And then I'm allowed to take the money. Now you understand this can collapse at any stage. Meaning, number one, you may not show up with the money because Shemitah canceled it. Number two, you may show up with the money, but after I say you don't have to, you say, oh, fine, you know, and you disappear. You know? But what's supposed to be is, on one hand, you have a moral obligation to offer. I have a moral obligation to initially refuse, but then it's proper for you to reoffer it, and then I can take it.
Okay. And my last, hopefully simple question is, how does it apply to Jews outside Eretz Yisrael?
Exactly the same way. Shemitah of agriculture only applies to Israel. Shemitah of money applies everywhere. So it's exactly the same. You should know this. If you are owed money, then before the end of the next Shemitah year, you must stand up in front of a beis din and make a prisma. There'll be prisma forms that'll be available in most synagogues and the like. Because if you don't, you have forfeited the right to collect your debt. Now, Shemitah does not apply to debts that are owed by non-Jews, so that you don't have to worry about. If it's owed by a Jew, you must make a prisma or you lose the ability to collect the debt.
I suppose you're going to cover this in the subject of interest, but there's a prohibition of Jews owing money.
Yes.
Is that prohibition of money just applies to lending money to Jews?
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
You can't lend money to a Jew
with interest. That's correct.
But
well, we will discuss that. The laws of interest, I guess, are not so much an ethical issue because reasonable interest is not necessarily immoral, but it is an extremely important and difficult halachic issue. And that is, the Torah says a Jew cannot charge another Jew interest. That is usur, no matter how long the loan, etc. We'll discuss, you know, can one be a Jewish banker? Right? We discussed, can you be a Jewish reporter, everything else. Can you be a Jewish banker? Okay, we'll discuss this. What time is it, 4:00? Okay. Okay, all right, so we'll continue. Is there a little vacation tomorrow? I'm not sure what...
We're off until Sunday.
Yeah, you're off until Sunday? Okay.
Why are you?
This is the midwinter break.